the invitation. It was a very fun week. Learned a lot. Before I talk about this, I wanted to do a little plug-in for something else, which is that especially those of you who have not looked at these problems before may get the wrong impression that the only interesting questions about random walks in random environment have to do with reversible random walks, etc. So I didn't want to pose it as an open problem in the beginning of the week, but I just wanted to mention that this is not the case. So just those of you who know it can sleep for the next 5 minutes. Those who have never seen it, here is a very simple model that has resisted numerous attempts to be solved. So suppose I'm on ZD, and on each side of the lattice I put a probability measure on the neighbors, okay, which I denote by omega x, x plus dot. So those, of course, are going eventually to be random, or not eventually. Now the next step is we're going to make those random. So we have an environment. Each time you are at a site, you use whatever omega is at that site to pick a neighbor and move there. Okay? And you may put the assumption that you are IID, say, nearest neighbor, and uniform elliptic. So uniform elliptic means that it's the probability to go to any of your neighbor is strictly positive, bounded below by a constant that does not depend on omega. No. Each site, the omega x's are IID. So each site, the probability to go to your neighbor is a function of what you find at that site, and there is no relation between the two. The one across has nothing to do with it. Okay? So that's exactly why it is not of the type of walk that we have been discussing this week, because it is not naturally reversible, and many of the tools are not available. So start a random walk in random environment. Here are the open problems. First of all, is there a limiting speed at all? If you do have limiting speed, is it recurrent or transient? Is it always recurrent or transient? And so the general question would be, in dimension 2, is it always recurrent? If the speed is zero, in dimension 3, is it always transient? Now, one comment about that, another type of question, is that in dimension 1, this problem is completely analyzed, but dimension 1, in a certain sense, is a cheat because it is reversible, of course. It is a random walk on a tree. So, however, in dimension 1, from which much of the intuition could come, you do have situations in which you are transient to infinity, but the speed is zero. Is that possible in higher dimension, in particular in dimension 2? And one warning to make about this model is that there exist examples in which the expected drift at a site, so in say in the one direction, so this is the expectation of this random variable, is strictly positive, but the walk is transient in the opposite direction with speed, with negative speed. And not only these examples exist, but these examples can be made for arbitrary small perturbation of simple random walk. So give me an epsilon. In high enough dimension, give me an epsilon, I can construct for you an example in which these two things happen. And the omega is as close is close to 1 over 2D by a distance less than epsilon. Okay? So, say, to be concrete, in dimension 7, I can do such a thing. So any epsilon you give me in dimension 7, I can construct such an epsilon. So it's really, okay, so now that we solved all the problems of the week, here is a grown-up version. Yes?
Should we,
Okay, so there are results, there are recent results that say, for example, that in the perturbative regime, the one that I just told you that in the perturbative regime, bad things can happen, even perturbative. But there are results that say that if you impose an additional symmetry condition on the law, okay, that prevents this kind of behavior, then everything is nice. So by condition on the law, I mean that the law of the environment is invariant under rotations. And so this makes sure that the annealed speed at least is zero. And okay, so that was just a plug-in. So I'm going to discuss today something much simpler. And it's joint work with Yuval. So the model is a random walk on trees. So, but these trees are going to have weighted edges. So we are going to try to start with a Galton-Watson tree with probability distribution of offspring denoted by pk. So pk is the probability that a vertex has k offspring. And we are going to start a random walk on that tree with the weights as I depicted in the picture. Actually, this picture is shifted a bit. So to be consistent with this picture, this should be lambda. So the probability to move towards your descendant, so if you are at U, the probability to move to a descendant V is just 1 over lambda plus du. Du is a number of descendants of U. Okay, so it's not the degree, it's the number of descendants. At the root, it is the degree, but everywhere else, it is, we denote by du the number of descendants. So, this, of course, requires you to fix the root. So this is a rooted tree, and the lambda is with respect to that rooted tree. And throughout, I'm going to avoid the bad cases of possible extinctions. So P naught is 0, and P1 is less than 1, so that we truly have a tree and not a pipe. Not a random walk on a pipe. And I'm also going to assume some exponential moment of the distribution of descendants. This assumption is probably not necessary, but it simplifies quite a bit the analysis, so that's what we are going to do. I have not thought seriously about the extinction case. So if you condition on non-extinction, what happens? I've not thought seriously about that, so I don't want to say anything. Finally, M is the mean number of descendants in the tree. Okay? Okay, so there are lots of things known. So Russ is here, and certainly he did important work in the early 90s, and there are quite a few papers in the early 90s that analyzed, early to mid 90s, that analyzed this model. And in particular, the following things are known. So if lambda is larger than m, which means you bias the walk towards the root, okay, lambda is the amount of bias towards the root. The larger lambda is, the more homesick the walk is. Okay? Then Xn is positive recurrent, and in particular, Xn over n goes to 0. Where by absolute value of Xn, I denote the distance from the root. If lambda is less than m, so this means that typically you have drift away from the root, then Xn is transient, and not only is it transient, but there is a positive speed And the existence of this positive speed is due to the existence of regeneration times. Those are times in which the walker reaches a vertex and never backtracks. And once you have such time, you can introduce an independent structure under the annealed measure on the walk. And this independent structure now allows you to do analysis. So that's the key to the proof of this result. It is also known that if lambda equal 1, then there is a natural measure on the environment viewed from the point of view of the particle. And this natural measure is depicted in this little picture here. I think Russ mentioned it the other day. And this measure allows you to compute the speed. So remember, lambda equal 1, under my assumptions, m is larger than 1. So lambda equal 1 means that you are transient and you have a positive speed. And as far as I know, this is the only case in which the velocity is known explicitly. Right? I don't think this has improved. Okay. That this measure. Sorry? Well, there's a natural candidate to this measure. I don't want to get into that, but okay, now it looks natural. I don't know what was the situation before they found it, but it's just not clear what would be the, I mean, it's not clear how to guess even an explicit measures are rare and far between, so that's a case where you have an explicit measure. Well, this is just you. This is how the tree looks from the point of view of the GW, Galton Watson. I'm sorry. Yeah, so you just glue together at the root one more edge. And if you compute the drift here for such a tree, you see that this is a expected velocity. Okay, and in this situation, because of the existence of regeneration times, and because it is not too hard to get good tails on the regeneration time, so not just that the expected value of the regeneration time is finite, but higher moment as well, Pyo has shown that you can get a central limit theorem, there are large deviation results. I don't want to get into all that. That's not. Okay, so what I want to focus on, and in fact, although, yeah, I'm sorry, I'll get back to that later. So I want to focus on the case lambda equal m, which is a transient, a recurrent case, but a null recurrent case. And this is a critical case because below it you have a positive speed. Above it, you are a positive recurrent. And I want to ask about central limit theorems. And one of the difficulties is that there is no expression for an invariant measure viewed from the point of view of the particle in that situation. So that's what I want to do. Questions? Okay. So this turns out in the first step to be... I'm sorry. Before I say that, here is a theorem. So the theorem is that if you are at that critical situation, so lambda equals m, there exists a deterministic constant, positive, such that quenched, namely conditioned on the realization of the tree, the path of the random walk, the path of distance from the root, satisfies the CLT in the sense that it looks like the absolute value of Brownian motion. Okay? Of course, it cannot satisfy a CLT because it cannot be negative. But that is just the issue of the absolute value. Okay? The case lambda less than m is much easier, but let me mention it for completeness. So if you take the path, the location, you subtract the deterministic centering, Vt, and you normalize, you converge to actually a true Brownian motion. Though the issue of being negative doesn't appear, because anyway you run away from the root, so you definitely can be negative in this scaling. Okay, so those are the statements, and I'm going to focus on this one. So that's what the real difficulty is. Questions so far? Yeah, you need to do, I mean, it's actually nowhere in the literature, but it's not. Yes, you just prove that the regeneration times have a 2 plus epsilon moment. This by itself proves only an annealed central limit theorem, but okay. It works. Okay, so the approach is similar to things that we have heard about, and in particular to the martingale approach that Marek was discussing in his talk. So we will have martingales, we will have correctors, although the details are quite different. I mean, the actual construction and the details are quite different. So I would like to say a few things about it. So the first difficulty, if you think about it, in the Galton-Watson problem, is that any invariant measure you're going to come up with, if you're going to come up with an invariant measure, is not going to be absolutely continuous with respect to the original measure. Reason being that after a large time, you don't expect to be at the root, right? So the invariant measure will not look like a rooted tree. We'll put any invariant measure would put weight zero to having no ancestor. And we are dealing here on not, it's not enough to look at the tree, because we have this special direction, this special ray that we have to keep track of. So it would not be enough to give an invariant measure to the tree viewed from the particle. You need the tree with a marked direction or a marked ray. So the Galton-Watson is not natural in that context. So you first cheat. Say, okay, let's put ourselves from the beginning on infinite trees with a marked ray, which is actually what happened before, except that before it didn't really matter that much because lambda was 1. Now it's crucial to keep track of that ray. So we are going to modify the initial law. And the way to think about it is that you have an infinite tree with one ray marked, one semi-infinite ray marked. Okay, and this semi-infinite ray starts at the root and goes to minus infinity. And now you have a notion of height in this tree by the horocycle distance. So this level, I don't want to give the formal definition, but the picture should make it clear. H equals 0 means you are at the same level as the root. And then H equals 1, you are at level 1. Above, H equal minus 1, you are at level 1 below, etc. So this is a tree. And now let me define a measure on this tree, which turns out to have an important role and actually is already present in the work of Lyons, Behrens, and Pimentel in various works, in various guys. So somehow this marked ray plays a special role. If you think of it in terms of the random walk, this is the ray. So if you think of eventually of the root as being where the random walk is, this ray connects it to the original root of the tree. So this root is not an arbitrary vertex. It is a vertex that we know has been visited by the random walk. Okay? And so it's sampled from the vertices at the bottom by the random walk, and then there's a natural way to think about it, which is to bias this ray, to make this ray have a little bit more descendant than a typical walk. So here is how you do it. You put the bias by doing a size bias on the number of descendants along the ray. Okay? So every vertex along the ray has a stochastically biased number of descendants, and all the rest have the Galton-Watson distribution. So you should think of it as a ray with slightly more descendants, and then hanging from it are Galton-Watson, standard Galton-Watson trees. There are other descriptions of that. For example, you can take your Galton-Watson, sample uniformly at level N, shift the root there and take weak limits. This will give you this construction. Okay. Now, one thing that is useful about trees is that we have a good control on population below. So let me denote by dn of v the size of the nth generation below v. Okay? It's a total population size below v. That's dn of v. Is that clear? So dn of the root is just the number of particles alive at generation n. Then it's a martingale argument to check that dn of v divided by m to the power n converges almost surely to a random variable, and under the assumption that I have put on my tree, this random variable has nice tails. In particular, it has exponential tails. Okay? Nice upper tails. And now, once you have such a random variable, there's a very natural martingale to look at, because these guys satisfy a recursive relation, right? Because W at an ancestor, you can relate to W at all its descendants by a linear relation. You multiply by lambda and you sum. But lambda equal m, so we are at that case, lambda equal m. So I will interchangeably say lambda and m. Okay? So, this is how you construct a martingale. So, your martingale is going to be on this infinite tree. Very simple, you just take partial sums of these W's along your path. Okay? And if you compute exactly because lambda equal m, this has zero. The martingale differences have zero mean. And this is a quench. This has nothing to do with the measure you put on the tree. This is always, I mean, of course, you need that to exist, but any quantity that satisfies the recursion relations will be a martingale under such a definition. Okay. So this is a martingale, and because of the tail estimates that I mentioned, you have also good estimates on the martingale differences, good moment bounds. Good a priori moment bounds on the martingale difference. You know that these quantities cannot be too large. Okay. So, let me introduce one more quantity. So S will be exactly the partial sum. So SV is a partial sum of this W's that create eventually the martingale. So this has nothing to do with the random walk. This is a definition on the tree. This is, if you want, something that will define the corrector for us in just a second. So SV for V, which is a descendant of the root, is just the sum of the W's along the way. If you are around here, then you take minus the sum here and you add the sum there. And with that definition, the martingale I talked about before is exactly S evaluated at the point XT. Okay? Remember, each time you go down, you subtract the W. Each time you go up, you add it. So that's why here you have to define the value by taking minus all this plus all that, all those. S is a function of the tree.
Relative to a root. That's right.
Okay. And then MT is S of XT. The martingale I talked about before. If you start at the root, then this is it. If you don't start at the root, there's an obvious shift by the value at which. So it will always be the martingale difference. The difference with your initial value will be always the martingale sequence. And it's easy to compute the increasing process of this martingale. It's an explicit computation. You just compute the second conditional moment, and you get this expression. What I want to emphasize about, so this is not the increasing process. These are the increments of the increasing process. And what I want to emphasize is that this is a function of the W's in a neighborhood of size 1 around you. It's not a local function. Let's be a little bit careful, because the W is a function of all the 3 below you. But it is a function of, once I give you the W's, it is local. Okay? Question so far about this. Okay. So if you remember Marek's talk, if we are going to construct a martingale, at some point we would like the increasing process to converge. That would be the first requirement in order to hope to get a central limit theorem. You want the increasing process to converge in order to apply a martingale central limit theorem, which means that the partial sums of these quantities that depend on where you are should converge. So that's an ergodic result. How can you make it converge? If you happen to be invariant under the Markov transition. Okay? So this is the point in which you would like to know an invariant measure for the environment viewed from the point of view of the particle, which in general does not come for free. And in particular, we do not know it for lambda not equal to m. But miraculously, there is an invariant measure. And once I tell you the invariant measure, you just go and check. It's not a hard computation. And you discover that this one is indeed invariant, and the invariant measure is a small, tiny defect on this measure IGW that was already in the literature, essentially. And the defect is at the origin. So the only thing is that at the origin, you don't know if you have visited below you or not. Right? If you think of the origin as the point of the, as the current location of the particle, you know above you, you are sure that you visited. But below you, maybe yes, maybe not. So the distribution of descendants at the origin turns out to be a mixture with weight half of the two possible things it could be, namely unbiased one and size bias. Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah, that's right. It's up in the picture. Yes. Yes. Sorry? R. Ah, reversible. So this measure is reversible under the Markov dynamics. Okay? So the measure on the environment, the walk induces a Markov chain on the environment simply by taking a shift with the current location of the walk. Okay? So that's a Markov chain in the space of environments. And I claim that this measure is, this Markov chain is reversing with respect to this measure. Okay. Okay, so that's a computation one has to check, and I don't want to do it here. Writing it formally is a bit of a pain, but it is true. So this is the fact that I just mentioned. And this fact, together with the estimate on the increments of your martingale, immediately give you an invariant principle for MT. Okay? If you started from IGW or IGWR, it doesn't matter. IGW and IGWR, by construction, are absolutely continuous with respect to each other. So if you have an invariant principle under one, it will be an invariant principle under the other. Sorry?
For doing what?
No, but this is, I have a martingale, so the only issue is the convergence. So you're saying you could also deal with other martingales. I agree. Sure. That's what you're saying, really. The standard way is just to construct other martingales or additive functionals. Yeah. But remember, this is only under this measure. We are not, we are really interested in Galton-Watson. This is an intermediate step. And also, we are not completely done because this is not giving the location. Not yet. Okay, that's exactly the size of the corrector that we were worried about before. Okay, so yes. So the first question is, look, we had this quantity that I called SV, which is the distance from the root. The partial sum of the W's from the root. We want to relate it to the distance, because the distance from the root is what we would like to compute. So, very naturally, you can think, well, SV over V should satisfy a law of large numbers. Just think of our original construction. If you take a particular ray and you go along the ray, okay, those W's are not independent, right? Because each one depends on the next one, etc. So they are not independent. However, because of branching off, they are almost independent. They forget very quickly their dependence because there are other... Let me draw a little picture to explain that. So suppose you are at the vertex V, and here is the root. So I'm saying that this one and this one, say, are not independent. Of course not, because this is the average of the value here with the value of W here. The W at this point is an average of the W is coming here. However, if you're far away, then the weight that is given to these particular ones is decreasing very rapidly along the tree. Think of the case P1 equals zero, then this becomes trivial to understand. In the case P1 positive, it requires a little bit more work. But in principle, this is the case. So the value here and the value here are very weakly correlated. And this implies that SV over V along a particular ray should converge by some kind of average law of large numbers. Okay? And therefore, the value of the martingale should be related to the distance. If SV over V converges, then it means that if I give you SV, you know your distance from the origin. One slight thing to be careful about: if you pick a vertex here and you don't think too carefully, and you ask yourself, okay, what will it converge to? You would say it should converge to the expected value of W under the Galton-Watson measure. But this is not quite true, because you pick your vertex according to where your particle is, or according to the construction, kind of uniform on the descendants below, and then that's exactly where the size biasing is coming. So the actual, what you can show is that for most points, a distance V from, at the distance N from the origin, the value of SV over V is close to the size bias expectation of W. This is again why size bias is entering in all these considerations. And in fact, you can also prove an auxiliary estimate that says that the random walk will not sample the part of the tree where this is not approximately true. Okay? Will not with high probability. Okay, so we know now what is SV over V. We have a good candidate for corrector, namely, what we expect is that if eta denotes the expectation I just described, namely the size bias expectation of WV, or W0, then ZT, which is defined as the martingale divided by eta minus the height from the root, this should be small. Okay? Now, This is not expected to be necessarily small in a neighborhood of the origin, because near the origin you didn't have enough averaging for the law of large number to kick in. So in order to show that this is true, you want to say that you are not near the origin. Now you expect for a particular t to not be near the origin if you have a central limit theorem. You actually expect to be a distance square root t from the origin. So this is reasonable to expect. And the way you prove that for most t this indeed is small is you gave an a priori estimate on how much time you spend near the origin. Okay, so you give an a priori rough estimate saying you cannot spend too long in a neighborhood of the origin. If you are not near the origin, the law of large numbers I described before kicks in, and you know that this corrector is small. Okay. So, where am I so far? So, if you believe the steps that I have sketched, this would give you a complete central limit theorem for the random walk on the IGWR tree or on the IGW tree, whatever one, whichever one of the two you want to work with. And it gets it quenched. But remember, I'm not interested in IGWR, I'm interested in Galton-Watson. So how do you go back to Galton-Watson from this result? Okay, that's the next question I would like to explore. Now, intuitively, before I describe it, this should be true, because after a while, the random walk has forgotten that it's in a Galton-Watson tree, because it is somewhere deep. You know also for the random walk on the Galton-Watson tree that it cannot spend too long near the origin. This is easy to check by resistance computations. There are many, many different arguments that lead to the same conclusion. So you know that you are way down in the tree. When you are way down in the tree, what you should see is essentially IGW. But I don't know how to prove something like that directly. Maybe it is possible, but I don't know. So the way we do it is slightly different. And what we are going to do is to couple a random walk on a Galton-Watson tree with a random walk on a IGW tree. But couple is actually not the right word, because we do not couple them one, they do not go together forever. Rather, it's going to be a dirty coupling, namely, that for a while they will go together, then they will separate, go their own way, and then they will meet again. Let me try to explain what is a coupling. And I'll explain it by a picture, because writing it is too painful. Writing it here. So, what I described to you, even though, so, we have a Galton-Watson tree, but let's forget a moment about the existence of this underlying tree, and let's construct it as the particle goes along. So, the argument I'm going to describe is going to be as if everything is annealed, and as if I construct it as I go along, although all the definitions are actually quenched. So actually the coupling will give a coupling from a quenched Galton-Watson tree into an IGW. So here is my walk. What I'm going to describe by a green dot is the current location of the particle. So this is time one. At time one, the particle went somewhere, it's a Galton-Watson tree. So I call this time tau 1. Now at tau 1, the particle is at a fresh point, right? Because it's in a vertex that it has never visited before, that a priori knew nothing about. In particular, it had no constraint about from the history of the path. Okay, by looking at the history of the path alone, you cannot say anything about the degree of that vertex. So now, I call this a good excursion, or a fresh excursion, if you wish. So, suppose at time 2, the particle went to a new location, then it came back, then it went to a new location, then it came back, and then it jumped back to the origin. The part in green is going to be a good excursion. It's one in which knowing what happened up to time tau 1, and in particular knowing the vertices up to time tau 1, tells me nothing about the future vertices. Okay? I call this time eta 1. So is it clear how tau 1 and eta 1 are defined? So again, let me repeat. Tau 1 is the arrival to a fresh point. Once you arrived at the fresh point, you start your excursion, marking your excursion, and you stop when you retreat back from the fresh point. Okay? Then at the next step, maybe the walk jumped to the same location. It could have jumped sideways, in which case this would have been a fresh point and a new fresh excursion would start. But in the picture I depicted here, it actually jumped here. So this is not a fresh point. And in the next step, it jumps to a fresh point. So this will be tau 2. And now a fresh excursion starts until I fall back 1. Okay? Is that clear? So in this example, tau 1 was 1, eta 1 was 6, tau 2 was 8. And this part, this green little part, I call the good part or the good excursion. This is where the coupling will occur. So this part is going to be copied in the IGW situation. More precisely, we are going to construct the IGW tree as we go along with the Galton-Watson walk. Okay. And the black parts are the garbage parts. They are the dirty parts. They are the parts in which actually the walks will move independently. Okay? So here is in picture what I said in words. So this is the example that I had before. Here is how you construct. Here is how you construct the IGWR in this example. So first of all, First of all, you pick up a ray. This you do before you started. So the ray you mark from the very beginning with the right distribution, etc., etc. And now, yes, that's what I mean. That's exactly what I mean. So when I draw a vertex, it means I've decided on the degree, on the number of descendants of that vertex. Okay? And this I know how to do. And what is important, everything else is independent of it under the measure on the IGWR. So in the first step, our walk is going to jump somewhere. It could jump down here, or it could go down the ray. Points along the ray are not fresh points, never, because the degree has been determined. Okay? So we are going to wait until the first fresh time. At the first fresh time, we just glue our green first good excursion. Okay? Remember, I have prepared pieces of tree with pieces of excursions. So that's what I do. Then the walk continues. And then maybe it comes back down. Maybe it goes away. And maybe the next excursion is going to be glued here. Remember that in my original picture, the second excursion would have been glued in here. Right? Because tau 2 was here. Here started the second excursion. It would have been glued here. In this picture, it is not glued necessarily at the same location. This is a fresh point. Yeah, so my picture is not so good. So, yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right that this is misleading. And should have been, except that I don't have green now, should have been like that. Thanks. Okay? So now we are gluing these little pieces. Along the pieces, the paths are the same. Away from these green pieces, the paths do their independent things. I'm going to claim that the walks are similar. What does that mean? What do you need to check for this claim? If you want to infer a central limit theorem for the Galton-Watson from a central limit theorem for the random walk. First thing, I'm going only to measure things as distance from the ray, because this is like a Brownian motion reflected at essentially its running minimum. The random walk does not go, this ray has a drift toward minus infinity. So the distance you go up is very small. It's actually logarithmic at most by time t. And it has no effect on the central limit theorem whatsoever. So if you looked on the IGW walk, if it is an IGW walk, you look at the distance from the ray, this behaves like the absolute value of a Brownian motion. By the theorem we have already proved. So what do we need to prove now? We need to prove two things. First thing, the total time we spend in garbage region is small, little order of t, so that there will be no significant time change between the Galton-Watson and the IGW. By the way, I forgot to mention, it is clear that this construction gives you a random walk on the infinite tree that has an IGW R low. This is clear, because you never use anything from the past when you construct the next piece of the tree. Because you chose the degree at the origin to be according to IGWR. But actually, at this stage, it doesn't really matter. You could do both. They are absolutely continuous with respect to each other. Any almost sure statement here is an almost sure statement. So it doesn't really matter. You leave the origin anyway very fast. So you need to check that the total garbage time is small. And that the total garbage, not the total, but the maximal garbage distance you walked by time t is also small. Because what will be the difference between the distance from the ray in this walk here, on the IGW walk, and the distance from the root in the GW? Just the maximal length of the garbage distance. Okay? So, how do you do that? So here is the basic idea is the following. Let us look at the walk that each time you reach a fresh point, you simply wait until you fall back one. Okay? And disregard all that time. So your next step will always be one down. Okay? This is a garbage walk. This is a path that is marked by the walk during the garbage intervals. Okay? Now this is almost a random walk, but not quite, because at each such fresh point you get a kickback. Each time you reach a fresh point, slightly careful, it's a fresh point not for this walk, but for the other walk, but each time you reach a fresh point, you get a kickback. Which means that the previous martingale we had constructed is not a martingale, but it's a super martingale. The conditional expectation is actually less or equal to zero. Except for that, all is well. All good points, the expectation is zero. Only at fresh points, and the existence of this fresh point is measurable with respect to the relevant sigma field, which is not the sigma field. The filtration is not the filtration of the garbage walk, but actually the filtration of the original walk. That's fine. And now you have this quantity that is a super martingale. You still have good moment bounds, as I described before, so you cannot go too far in too short a time. Okay? You have to be slightly careful because time here is now measured as time of the garbage walk, not time of the original walk. However, you should also remember, so maybe I have many garbage points. For example, if by time t I have t garbage points, the garbage walk would go square root t distance and I'm doomed. Right? It's a martingale. We cannot hope that it goes less than a martingale. So I have to make sure that I don't have too many beginning of fresh excursion or too long a time on the garbage walk. But this is easy, because each time you reach a good excursion, you have a probability 1 over square root n to go a distance n before coming back to the origin. Right? Because this is just a resistance computation. Sorry, you have a probability 1 over square root n to go a distance square root n before going back to the origin. Therefore, after about square root n such attempts, you will make a distance square root n. So the actual random walk would have gotten to distance square root n by time that by having at most an order of square root n fresh points. So the time, the garbage time you have to worry about is not n, but square root n. And the Martingale argument now tells you that your typical displacement is n to the power 1/4, which is, of course, smaller than n to the power 1/2, and finishes the argument. So we are here in a situation in which you can prove that this coupling is noisy by an amount which is n to the power 1/4. No, we push epsilons all over the place. Of course. So when I say that's of course true. Because this is not the size of the corrector, remember. This is just the error in the coupling that we are discussing here. So this is not at all the type of question that you were asking. I think that the estimates on the corrector are much more precise under the measure IGWR. But here it's just a cheap way to avoid discussing the invariant measure in the GW tree. So I'm completely bypassing that question. Okay, that's it.